Welcome to Heels in the Courtroom, a podcast about successfully navigating law and life, featuring the women trial attorneys at the Simon Law Firm.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Heels in the Courtroom. I am Amy Gunn, and today I am joined by Erica Slater, Elizabeth McNulty, and Mary Simon. Hello, ladies.
Hey.
Today we are going to talk about books and book reports. There have been numerous books that we have read and referenced and learned from over the years, and wanted to share some of those with our listeners. I picked the Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. And this was a book written by Atul Gawande, who is a surgeon. It was written in 2009. He's also written a few other books, one called Better and Complications. I read this book a number of years ago. Largely, I think I read a book review of it, or maybe listen to a podcast about it. Because he was a surgeon, and because we do, and I do a lot of medical malpractice litigation, I thought this could be helpful to learn how ingrained checklists are in the medical profession. And his view is that you need a checklist for just about anything you do in medicine. And he broadens that out to a lot of different professions, engineering, finance, those things. And I haven't reread it entirely, but I can give a pretty good outline. And then at the end, I want to, y'all will be happy to know, I want to try to create a checklist on a particular issue that we see in our practice and see what we can come up with. So by way of background, the Checklist Manifesto, it's got some philosophy, it's got some psychology embedded in it. And basically, it comes down to a few different things in science. And it's about human fallibility, right? What we're trying to prevent is mistakes. So Dr. Gawande digs down at the beginning and tries to figure out why are mistakes made. And there are a number of reasons for that. He lists ignorance, which is really just not knowing things, and ineptitude, which is knowing things but not applying that knowledge. And that part, I think, is what we really are trying to prevent, especially in a professional situation. Like, we know a whole bunch of stuff. We're not ignorant of how to do things. But based on circumstances and being distracted and all kinds of other things, we may fail to do things. And that he considers ineptitude. At the beginning of the book, he gives a little story about a conversation he was having with a surgeon who had a patient in the OR. It was a belly surgery. And as he's performing the belly surgery, the patient loses the heart rate. The doctor has to keep his head about him and figure out what is causing this. And the first thing he thought of was a massive bleed. But he's got his belly open, but he sees no bleed. Then he's talking to the anesthesiologist, because another reason a heart can stop is that you've got an airway compromised. And the anesthesiologist says, everything is fine. The airway is clear. And they thought about a pulmonary embolism, a few other things, a lung collapse. And they went through these, like, brainstorming on the spot. And finally, the doctor, and he's doing CPR, and he's trying to keep him alive. And finally, the doctor said, was he given any particular medication other than anesthetic? And finally, the anesthesiologist said, oh yeah, I looked at the labs before putting him under, and he had low potassium. So I gave him a quick dose of potassium, because really low potassium can cause a heart attack, but so can really high potassium. And so they dug the bag out of the trash and noticed that it was the wrong dose. They had overdosed him on potassium. Wow. And they were able to give him additional medications. And the only reason this surgeon was telling this story is because why?
He lived.
It turned out okay. But that sort of brought up the idea of if there had been a checklist in place, instead of wasting time with the brainstorming and the conversation back and forth, somebody in the OR could have pulled it up and gone, 1, 2, 3, 4. And there would have been way less time wasted. And so then you figure out, well, how do I make a checklist? Where do I even start with a checklist? Another interesting part of the book was defining types of problems that exist in our world, either professionally and personally. He cites to two professors who study the science of complexity. Yes, that is a thing. Brenda Zimmerman and Shalom Gluberman. And they come down, there's three types of problems. Simple problems, complicated problems, and complex problems. Simple problems are like recipes, how to bake chicken, how to make a casserole. Complicated problems are sending a rocket to the moon. And I think that would certainly be a complicating issue.
It's a big step between the two of those.
Yeah, I think so too.
I struggle with chicken.
Yeah. I've got a good
just
recipe.
Saying.
And then complex problems. And the example they give of a complex problem is raising a child. So I just don't think a checklist is going to work for raising a child. But it certainly could work for a simple problem like how to bake chicken, or even a more complicated problem like how to send a rocket to the moon. So you start with, is the problem I'm trying to create a checklist for even able? Does it lend itself to a checklist? And I think in our profession, the answer is mostly yes.
Are all three of those categories ones that checklists apply to? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yes. And I'd say no. I think the reason for delineating these three categories is to point out that not every single problem can be solved with the checklist, and identifying the complexity of the problem will allow you to sort of predict the success of a checklist in that circumstance. So he gives us a number of things to follow, and sort of on that point, there's a part of the book that explains the difference between a good and a bad checklist. Not necessarily a good or bad problem to solve, but a good or a bad checklist as you're trying to actually develop that checklist. And good checklists are, number one, precise. Number two, easy to use even under the most difficult situations. So that would be a real stressful situation like the OR example we talked about. And then the third is a good checklist provides only the most important steps. So you're not micromanaging every single thing. Now, the opposite of that are bad checklists. Bad checklists are vague and imprecise. They're too long. They're too hard to use. And this is my favorite. They treat the people who use them as dumb as they provide each and every step. Okay, so that to me is like, again, you don't need to micromanage every single thing. Okay, now you go to what makes a perfect checklist. And there, you shouldn't be surprised. There's a checklist for checklists.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Yes.
You said like an example of a simple problem is a recipe. Is the checklist part of that the steps of the recipe? Or is the checklist part of that like this is how you approach making a meal? Because in my head, I'm thinking like, okay, so we're baking chicken, right? So you go through your recipe, you do this, that, ingredients, whatever. But if you had a checklist for approaching a recipe, you would read the recipe first, you know, collect your ingredients, prepare your ingredients, you know, execute the recipe. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
and
what's the difference?
Right. I think that the difference is what you want to use it for. So I think they're both appropriate. I think they're both checklists. The first one that you describe is, how do I even get to the point where I want to make this chicken? What do I have to do? And so, as you say, you got to buy the ingredients. You have to. But I do think that a simple recipe includes those things. It includes what ingredients you need, what temperature to set the oven to, and the steps, specific steps you take. So I'm thinking about the Blue Apron. I have Blue Apron meal service. And I don't cook, y'all, but I can follow a recipe. And I feel real good about myself when I'm able to do that. And that is made for dummies like me. That includes pictures, and it starts with, it gives you the ingredients. So that part's easy. It gives me the ingredients. And then it starts with wash the broccoli. Okay.
Should note that you're married to like an approaching gourmet chef.
I am the exact same.
That's why you don't cook.
I can't even. Yeah.
I know. But I do feel good when it's done, although I burn things a lot and I follow the recipe. So it's got to be my oven, but we digress. So Erica, to answer your question, I think that the idea is a checklist is the recipe, and you implement these good and bad elements of a checklist. If you're too detailed, it's bad. But it should include the ingredients, what time to set the oven to, and those types of things. So then you go on to what is a perfect checklist, and here are the rules for a checklist. Okay, there are 7. That's kind of a lot, but we'll go through them. You have to decide a pause point at which the checklist is supposed to be used. So you determine the time or the when of the checklist. So, for example, with a recipe, you might want to check it in the morning to decide whether you need to go to the grocery store to get the ingredients. Then the next step is decide whether you want a do confirm or a read do checklist. I know this is in the weeds, so let me help you understand that, because I had to read on. A do confirm list means that you have to pause and check if what's going on the list has been done. So in the middle of that OR experience, you have to pause and say, okay, did we do this? Yes. Did we do this? Yes. A read do list means you carry out the task as if you're following the recipe, which is, okay, do this, now do this, now do that. So I think something in our area, which we're going to do here in a minute, but I think with our protocols and procedures, we're probably more like a do confirm. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
That we do a lot of things by rote. Everybody sort of knows what to do when a case comes in or when something happens. And I think the best use that I can think of for a checklist would be before something big happens, I got to make sure I did everything right. Mm-hmm. So sort of a do confirm. All right, 3, a checklist can't be too long. It needs to be between 5 and 9 items. I think that's oddly specific.
Yeah.
It sounds like maybe there's some science to that. I don't know, but we'll go with it. Focus on the killer items, which are the items most dangerous to skip. So in our case, you know, statute of limitations would be a killer item. Making sure that we communicate with our client, things that can get us in trouble if we fail to do it. 5, keeping the wording simple and exact. That seems good. 6, 1 page. Literally 1 page. You can stick it on the wall, look at it on your phone, 1 page. It also says avoid unnecessary colors. I guess too many colors are distracting. I know. You like colors.
Yeah.
And it says use both upper and lower case. I think we'll have to see what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And then finally, test the checklist in the real world and keep improving it. So you can't just write it and be like, here it is. Good luck to you. Follow this and everything will be great. You have to implement it. And like a lot of things in life, it's fluid. So you can't be afraid to tweak it if a certain circumstance requires that. Okay, and then one of my favorite things it talks about, because I really resemble this, is checklists are not fun because they're kind of boring and people can be lazy. And that's why I say I resemble that, because I'm like, I don't need a checklist, right? I've done this a long time. But I think some of it's kind of ego. And the author says what stops us from using checklists is it's an embarrassment or a feeling that comes from deep inside. He says, we believe that those whom we call heroes, those who've achieved a lot, don't follow the rules, right? They improvise, they're shoot from the hip, and those are the people that we really admire. And he's like, that's great, but that's how mistakes are made. Mm-hmm. So take your ego out of it.
This is medicine.
This ain't politics. This is medicine, and get your checklist done. So, with your permission, ladies, what I thought would be fun is to try to follow those rules and put together a checklist for something that we do on the regular on a regular basis. So I'm thinking maybe we could do something kind of easy, like steps to prepare for a mediation. Okay. I'm seeing some nods.
That's
not okay. A lot of enthusiasm, but that's okay.
That sounds good. Because I'm thinking in my head, too, is a checklist is for you are creating it for yourself.
Yes. And your team.
Okay.
You and your team. Like what? And so here's the scenario. I'm walking into a mediation for a really important case. that you believe likely should settle, and you've got trial less than a month away. So this is, you're at your best opportunity to, you know, if it's going to settle, this is the right time to settle it. So when I walk into a mediation, to, in order to be prepared and to look like I'm doing the best job I can for my client, how do I get myself there? So the thing that immediately comes to mind, and I don't think this is, we can probably tweak the order. He doesn't give us any advice about whether the most important thing should be at the top or the bottom. So I guess we'll have to figure that out. But I need to know, this is simple. I need to know what my contract is and what my expenses are and whether there's any liens, because the client is going to want to know what.
How much they're putting in their pocket.
That was beautiful. Yeah. So if I walk in the door and I can't answer that question because I don't have my expenses printed out, that's an embarrassment. So I'm going to say, I don't know what the right words for that are, but basically
to like determine have, the economics.
Yeah, the economics.
Or the numbers. Maybe right. That's not specific enough.
Numbers, the documents to calculate. I'm breaking a rule already. Too many words. Net settlement. How about that? Something like that. We'll work on that.
Yeah, draft settlement allocation or yeah, something like that.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's one. Anybody else?
I have client permission. I'm just going to rattle off things that came to mind. Client permission, confirm date, location, pick mediator.
Okay. I think I'm going to say I like the pick the mediator, maybe also vet the mediator.
I would say understand who's attending.
Okay. Yeah, who's going to be there?
And understand who's attending and their perspectives, meaning their money.
Yeah, are the money people coming?
Yeah.
Because that's a good point.
Who?
Confirm what? Authority.
Yeah.
Okay, confirm authority.
Yeah.
But also confirm, that might be the same thing. Confirm authority probably is the same thing as confirm limits, right? Like policy limits or how much there's going to be.
And
if you walk in and you're like, I need $10 million. Like, we got one, lady.
Yeah.
You should have known that by reading the interrogatory answers. Okay. So confirm authority and limits.
But we don't care.
Yeah. Well, that's our attitude. Okay. I'm thinking I usually like to have a conversation with the client beforehand explaining what's going to happen. So an informational phone call with the client, because you don't want them to get there and have no idea what's going on.
And the most fun part of that is if you're working with the same mediator over and over, you know what their spiel is that they're going to give the client. And then you build rapport and trust by saying exactly what they're going to hear. And then they hear exactly word for word what you've told them they're going to hear. And they're like, wow, you knew it.
You know what's going on.
Okay, what else?
Draft out your conditions.
Do you mean as if in like a little mediation summary at the end of the day or beforehand?
I think it's important to understand what conditions, based on the case, what conditions you're willing to arrive at.
Okay.
So for example, if you will agree to confidentiality, that can't be the last conversation of the day. That needs to be a conversation with the client early on. If you're going to agree to, you know, a certain payment schedule, or are there things that are deal breakers for you? Yes, we'll settle, but we need to have the money in 10 days. So if there are important considerations for that particular settlement, I think those have to be thought about beforehand and communicated to your client and the mediator.
Agreed.
And or have a strategy for when you're communicating those.
So almost,
I think that's like the intellectual prep of a mediation.
So almost like deal breakers.
Yeah.
Or requirements.
Yeah.
As you say, conditions. That's very accurate. Okay. Draft conditions.
Yeah, case-specific conditions.
Yes.
Because that would also include like a trust, if you need to engage someone, if a trust needs to be set up or...
Right. Or like a condition that comes up a lot is when they start putting annuities in front of you or something for your client.
Yeah.
The condition is, do not do that. If we elect to do that, we will do that. So that's not part of the negotiation. That's something that you'll need to prep your client for and prep the mediator for. Like, don't bring those in here.
Right. That made me think about the conditions, it made me think about liens. Mm-hmm. So in the first one, we talked about like the economics of it, and we talked about fees and expenses and liens. But I think liens deserves a separate point, because you also don't want to get into a mediation and say, oh, well, there's a $100,000 lien by Blue Cross Blue Shield, we think. I mean, we haven't checked on it for a while, and I have no idea whether they'll take a discount. I think there needs to be some homework done on the type of lien, whether it's public or private. If you have Medicare or Medicaid, when's the last time the lien was updated from those entities? So I think you need to know a little bit about the liens on the case.
Yeah, maybe as a separate one, instead of draft settlement allocation, just do a separate one that says determined liens.
Yeah, exactly. Again, not any particular order. Determine fees and expenses. That's going to be one. And that's sort of like a draft allocation. Determine liens, or at least research liens, I think is probably better. Three, make sure you've vetted your mediator. Because if it is somebody that you haven't used before, and that comes up occasionally, sometimes I'll have defendants who, or there's a conflict with one of our regular mediators, and I always like to say, I don't care who you pick, no one's going to tell me what my case is worth, right? But I say that sort of with a lot of hubris, but then I really do want to know, like, what was this background of this guy? If this person was on, or gal, if this person was on the bench, mm-hmm. what's the reputation? And I call around to people, maybe practiced in front of him or her, and try to do a little bit of research. So vet the mediator. Confirm authority or limits of policies. Five, have a phone call with the client on expectations. And six, draft conditions. And I think that's...
The only one we didn't do was like logistics. Like actually...
Okay. Yeah, I think that's right. Logistics. Where am I going?
Yeah, what format, where, when, that type of stuff.
Yeah. Okay, that's seven. I like that. See, this is fun and easy.
Yeah, this is, I like checklists.
Good. Okay, so listeners, I think that as long as it's a simple problem, I think in our world, these checklists work. We're not building a rocket. But as long as it's a simple problem, you could easily go through those suggestions and create a checklist for almost anything. So let's go back to see if we followed the rules.
Right, yeah.
And I know we're doing this pretty quickly, but generally, so a pause period. Okay, I think we talked about this is something that I personally would want to do a day, or probably actually at this point, a week beforehand. It makes sense to say, okay, I've got a mediation a week from now. Have I talked to the client? Where am I going? Who's the mediator? I think probably 1 week ahead of time makes sense.
I do think, though, for your team, it would be important for them to be aware of it, because there are things that they would need to do well in advance of just a week.
Yes. Getting like updates from Medicare or something.
If those things hadn't been done and it was a week advance, you wouldn't have enough time to do some of the things on the list.
And see, in my brain, I'm wondering, is that even a different checklist of like a... I know this is where my brain just spirals into checklist land, because I'm thinking about... expenses. Have you confirmed with your experts? You got all the expenses in? Are all the bills paid? Do we have so it's almost...
How about this? How about when the mediation gets set on the calendar? It's usually a few weeks out. Then the protocol is to attach the checklist to the calendar invite.
Got it.
And instruct the staff to be like, okay, check the checklist now. And see what needs to be done and start working on those things. That could almost be the automatic trigger. And then I like attaching it to the...
That's the redo calendar. Part.
Yeah, exactly. That's the next issue. The redo confirm or redo. Actually, you could do both of those.
Yeah, with that list.
All right. 5 to 9 items. We have 7. Perfection. Right in the middle.
Perfect.
Focus on killer items. I think we did that. I mean, there's a lot of other little things that you have to worry about, like, do I park in the garage? Who's going to pay parking? I mean, we're not going to micromanage. Simple and exact. Probably I could work on that with a little more time, a little bit more pointed in the term.
But not bad.
But not bad.
Not bad.
One page. Yes, ma'am. One page. No colors. I don't think no colors. No, but I will use uppercase and lowercase. That just sounds grammatically correct. And then test it in the real world. I think that's yet to be seen. And I'm going to do this. I'm kind of excited about this.
Yeah, our listeners are going to be dying for an update.
And not going to forget all about it and be like, what? We did that?
Checklist for approaching podcast.
Yeah. Exactly.
I need one of those for sure.
I certainly
Pick
do.
Topic.
any of our listeners who has anything in their life that you would consider to be a simple problem that you'd like not to make mistakes on, or that you find yourself forgetting or just being distracted with life, I think that the Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right, is a good book to sort of read. And more importantly, just get your mind thinking about checklists being important and useful.
Most of the times when I forget things that are in my regular routine, it's because I haven't taken the second to think about the fact that there is a checklist to it. So the even thinking in my own head of, you know, the morning routine with my daughter and knowing, like, Mark and I just tag team everything, but we know what things have to be done. Like, we know the outfit of clothes needs to be extra, like one extra outfit in the bag. But if I don't actually think about it, sometimes I forget it. If I'm not actually just taking one second to think about all the things that need to get done, I like forget something every time. And it almost makes me want to do a checklist just for myself.
Yeah.
An internal, like, it will take me 5 seconds to sit there and be like, got it, did all the things.
Yeah. Just hang it on the kitchen on the way out the door.
Yeah. Just for my own brain. Cause part of this too, even sitting down thinking about steps in mediation, it's kind of nice to have the checklist, because then, to your point at the beginning, whether it's ego or embarrassment or whatever it is, the fact that it's there is also kind of like when you know you have a million other things going on, whether, you know, at home or at work or whatever, it's a nice, what's the right word, to lean back on
a
little
bit. It's a crutch.
It's a crutch to do that, you know.
So we have, there's several checklists here and there that have been passed around the firm, and there's two in particular that I do use on a regular basis, because you're doing things so fast, and especially if you're preparing for a deposition or preparing a client for a deposition, I get so, you know, focused on the facts or like the one thing that's glaring at you that's like an issue that you know you're going to be dealing with in a deposition, and I'll grab that, you know, client prep checklist and sometimes and I'll sit down with them and it's there. And it's so funny you mentioned, Amy, like, you know, it makes you feel incompetent or whatever. I do this little disclaimer to my clients, like, okay, I have this checklist here. We're not going to follow it. It's for me to go back later and make sure we've covered everything. And like, by and large, it's like, we haven't talked about what you're going to wear. You know, because that's not, because my brain is like focusing on, I need to sit down and talk to you about this issue that you're going to be asked about. And we're going to spend 80% of our time on that, because that's really the only thing we need to get. But like, if you forget to tell them, like, don't wear jeans, you know, like that's consequential.
Right.
So I've used that type of checklist and it's been really helpful. And the basicness of it is what makes it useful, because it is universal to a case, because like the author is saying, you trust that person using it, that they're going to understand their own parts of, in this case, the facts of your case that need special attention. You don't need a, you know, item that says, think about the issues in your case and address what the most important thing you need to prepare for is. You know, it's like, no, you just need to remember to tell them not to wear jeans.
Right. So on that same notion, the author says the value, sort of sums up the value of the checklist, is the checklist gets the dumb stuff out of the way, the routines your brain shouldn't have to occupy itself with, and lets it rise above to focus on the hard stuff. And that's what we're looking for. We know what the easy stuff is. And if you write it down and just have it routine right there, then you can open your brain up to figure out really the, you know, not what somebody should wear, but how to win the case.
Yeah.
How to win.
Exactly.
Well, listeners, thank you for going on this journey with us today, developing our checklist. Hopefully you all might find some inspiration in this and put your own checklists together, whether professionally or personally. So thank you for joining us for another episode of Heels in the Courtroom. Our episodes drop every other week. We'll see you next time.
Heels in the Courtroom is brought to you by the Simon Law Firm. At the Simon Law Firm PC, we believe in the power of pooling resources in order to create powerful results. We often lend our trial skills and experience to lawyers around the country to achieve better results for their clients. Our attorneys welcome the opportunity to work with you on your case, offering vast resources, seasoned litigators, and a sterling reputation. You can contact us at 314-241-2929. And if you enjoyed the podcast, feel free to share your thoughts with Amy, Liz, Erica, Mary, Elizabeth at heelsinthecourtroom.law. And subscribe today, because the best lawyers never stop learning.